This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Janet Yellen has said it before, and she said it again today. She knows you want to know when the Fed's going to raise interest rates.
But our actual policy decisions over time will depend on evolving economic conditions.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 17th of June today, which makes it, by my very rough count, 3,275 days since the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates. Tomorrow will be 3,276. For today, the Fed met and did not raise. Chair Janet Yellen and the gang on the Federal Open Market Committee did have some things to say, though, about the economy and rates and the future thereof. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer was at Dr. Yellen's press conference today. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so a couple of things to talk about here with the Fed. First of all, playing off that cut I played up in the open, it's going to depend on the data. And also, Dr. Yellen said it's going to be gradual whenever the Fed acts.
Yeah, that's the Fed's new watchword, gradual, gradual, gradual. Yellen kept saying that a majority of Fed policymakers in this survey that they do before every meeting did see interest rate increases in our future this year, but only as long as economic conditions were right for that. And she kept emphasizing that even once they start raising interest rates, it's going to be gradual. It's not like they're going to double overnight.
What did she say? What did the Fed have to say about the overall health of the economy? Because that's, you know, the other thing that happens at these meetings.
Yeah, the Fed kind of does a pulse check of the economy. Yellen said we're moving in the right direction, but we're not there yet. The FOMC, the Fed committee, actually revised its expectations for economic growth, for GDP growth this year. They're saying the economy isn't going to grow quite as fast, but that's largely due to temporary factors like what happened in the first quarter. You may remember there was a port strike in your neck of the woods. We had a terrible winter in my neck of the woods. Inflation was not quite where the Fed wanted it because oil prices were down and U.S. exports were down. But Yellen says, look, those are all just temporary things. It's going to get better.
One last thing before I let you go, Nancy. The international part of this whole thing, she talked about Greece a little bit. She talked about sort of the global economy. And she also had a very gentle thing to say about the managing director of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, who said the other day, the IMF did, that the Fed ought to wait on interest rates. What did Chair Yellen have to say?
Yeah, gentle but firm, Kai. The head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, actually called on the Fed to hold off on a rate increase until 2016. But Yellen said, look, we are going to focus on the economy, on the numbers, on inflation, on the jobless rate. And if all those numbers are in line, we're going to raise rates this year.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer at the Eccles Building on the Mall in Washington, D.C., the Federal Reserve Building. Nancy, thanks very much.
Hey, you're welcome.
If you were to consult your list of zeitgeisty economic buzzwords, somewhere near the top would be the phrase the sharing economy, that thing that's been happening the past couple of years where technology has allowed for the sharing of underutilized resources to get all economists on you. Airbnb and housing is one. Uber and transportation is another, also the most commonly cited example of the sharing economy. About which, Uber that is, by the way, some big news today. The California Labor Commission has ruled that Uber drivers, who the company insists are simply contractors for them, are actually Uber's employees. And that is a big thing, sharing economy-wise. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has that story.
Got a car? Turn it into a money machine. So says Uber's website. Sounds tempting, huh? But Uber drivers pay for their own gas, their own insurance, They don't get paid for waiting time.
And that is, of course, one of the reasons why Uber has been so successful, because they don't carry these costs.
Gerald Friedman teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says the ruling could set a precedent for millions of independent workers around the country.
And it's going to encourage suits like this in other states.
He says over the years, the independent contractor workforce has grown, partly because employers don't have to pay things like overtime or health benefits. John Paul Ferguson teaches strategy at Stanford's Business School. He says if Uber drivers are considered employees, that means higher labor costs. And ultimately,
we would probably see that passed on as slightly higher prices to end customers.
But that won't kill Uber's success, Ferguson says. It'll just give them less of an advantage over regular cab companies. As to how this ruling might affect other app-based services like Airbnb or TaskRabbit,
there's going to be a lot, I think, of careful parsing of how different firms have treated the people who are using their apps to provide services to people.
He says it'll probably depend on what kind of contracts exist between the firms and the service providers. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street today were, shall we say, mildly encouraged by the news from the Fed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're doing a series this week about the perilous state of the infrastructure in this country. The power grid, the water supply, the roads, all the stuff that an economy pretty much has to have to function. Except in this country, that stuff keeps on breaking. So this week, why it keeps breaking and why it's so hard to fix it in a series called The Weak Link. Today, interestingly enough, a piece of infrastructure that so far hasn't been built. A 4.5-mile stretch of would-be highway here in Los Angeles that people have been fighting over for 59 years and is, as it turns out, a real good example of why this whole subject is so hard. Because it's got everything. NIMBYism, bureaucratic tangles, haves versus have-nots, regional politics, and lots of money. It's called the 710 Gap, just northeast of downtown L.A., between Pasadena and the city of Alhambra, where two interstates, the 210 and the 710, were, once upon a time, supposed to connect. Instead, they just end 4.5 miles apart. To get there,
10 to the 5 to the 134.
This being L.A.
And then down. We're just going to put some miles on this, baby.
You got to take some freeways.
No such thing as too many highways.
Highways are built in segments, as the 710 was, up from the Port of Long Beach north to Alhambra. But when time came to build the 4.5 miles from Alhambra to Pasadena back in the 1990s, locals objected. They sued, and they got an injunction. And since then, thousands of cars every day have been dumping out onto surface streets in the surrounding cities.
And here it is. So you'd think, right, that this was going to turn into actually something, but what it is functionally is just a bunch on-ramp and off-ramp and exit ramps. Hang on.
You're pulled off smack into the middle of the median.
Look at that. We're practically off-road.
At the stub end of the 210.
All right. Showtime.
To see this guy.
My name is Anthony Portantino. I'm the former state assembly member that represented the area impacted by the 710 freeway. And I've been concerned and an opponent of this project for well over a decade.
Portantino is, as he said, a former state assemblyman. He's my former assemblyman in point of fact, because, full disclosure, if the 710 gap is ever closed, it's going to mean those thousands of cars every day are going to pass real, real close to my house.
I don't deny that there's a problem that needs to be solved. There is a problem that needs to be solved. My point is, let's actually solve it. And the best way to move people through the region is through a multimodal approach. Light rail, bus systems, traffic circulation. Let's do all of it, not just build a $10 billion hole in the ground that's going to make all of it worse.
Caltrans, the state transportation agency, and the L.A. Metropolitan Transit Authority have put four other options on the table besides that tunnel that Anthony Portantino called a hole in the ground. All of them would basically leave the gap open, but tackle traffic with light rail, bus lines, or fixes to existing roads. There is also an option to do nothing. But the 710 Gap is at the heart of a regional transit network that serves more than a million people in this part of L.A. A network that, oh, by the way, includes trucks from the Port of Los Angeles, the busiest container port in the country. And after 50-something years, the end game might, and I stress might here, be in sight.
There's no beware of dog sign, right?
So here's an example of how much of a mess this project is.
It's got hardwood floors.
Back decades ago, when the original plan, a surface highway, was actually going to happen, Caltrans bought up 460 houses along the right-of-way.
Smells like grandma's garage.
Houses that it was going to knock down to build that highway. The highway gets blocked by a lawsuit. Caltrans, the transportation agency, now becomes a real estate agency, a landlord, basically, with hundreds of homes that are now in desperate disrepair. Garrett Damrath is the chief environmental planner for Caltrans.
At this time, we are working on selling all of the excess land that we have there. It's about 460 properties. There have been several bills passed in the California legislature that are directing us to sell those properties off.
Yeah, so the question is, how much is it going to cost to rehabilitate them and then sell them?
Well, what we're trying to do is sell them as is.
Oh, wow.
You get in your car, you drive 5 miles south of the stub end of the 210, down along those surface streets into Alhambra.
Doing nothing won't solve the problem. Complete the 710 freeway. Look at that. It's right up there on that banner.
And you get the sense that a fix really can't come soon enough.
Here we are. Welcome to Alhambra, I suppose.
Alhambra holds a 710-day rally every year, smack in the middle of town, regional politics gone very local.
We cannot wait another 50 years! Let's close the gap!
Barbara Messina, the vice mayor of Alhambra, pretty much lays it on the line.
You know, it's basically the haves and the have-nots, okay? It was okay for the lower-income cities to give up their property to get the 710 to where it is now. Nobody made an issue of that. But because we're going further north now, God forbid, you know, the 210 going through La Cañada, you know, gets a little bit more traffic on it than we have to suffer with, so...
Bob Stevens is the president of the American Society of Civil Engineers. He has been in transportation planning his whole life, and the 710 Gap is as intractable an infrastructure problem as he's ever seen.
It's a project that has been studied and studied and studied, and that gap in 710 from Alhambra up through South Pasadena has been a real old struggle. It may be a record on how long it's taken to go from... building the road from both ends and having that gap that they can't get completed.
Can't get completed yet is probably a better way to say that. A draft proposal on those five alternatives, the tunnel and the rest of them, is out for public comment now. Completion date? Well, yeah, TBD. We'd love for you to be a part of this series and help us report on infrastructure where you live and work. We've teamed up with Waze, the navigation app. Here's how it works. You download the app, you tap the report icon down in the lower right corner. You tell us about infrastructures near where you live using the hashtag weeklink, and we'll put all your reports on a map on marketplace.org. Fixing highways and byways are only one of the infrastructure challenges we have. There are also the things beneath the streets. Yesterday, we heard Sarah Gardner on LA's aging water pipes, how vulnerable they are going to be when the big one hits, the big earthquake, that is, for those of you who don't live here. Turns out the LA Department of Water and Power is installing earthquake-resistant pipes just a couple of blocks from our studios here in downtown. Sarah went to have a look.
I'm Craig Davis, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. We're basically at the corner of Temple Street and Figueroa, and we're installing about 2,300 feet of the Japanese-manufactured earthquake-resistant ductile iron pipe. We have over 20 known faults that can rupture inside the city of Los Angeles and many more that could affect the city of Los Angeles, like the San Andreas.
I'm at the gasket right now. I'm going to ratchet this in past the gasket.
Now, this pipe has actually withstood many meters, 10 feet of ground movement. And this pipe hasn't, not only has it not been damaged, it hasn't even leaked. It continues to perform. So say the seismic waves start coming through, the pipe has to move with the ground because it's in the ground. So it'll move around without putting any stress or strain on the pipe. If we install it the same way the Japanese do, which the Kubota Corporation has taught us how to do, then we should expect the same performance that they've had over 40 years.
Sarah Gardner produced that for us. We've got the whole series. It's called The Weak Link, as well as a video of the 710 gap that I was talking about earlier, up on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
It's saving a lot of lives. It's we have about 600 kidney pair donation transplants a year right now in the United States. In 2000, we had two.
Algorithms and the organ market. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 31 points today after the Fed met. A 10th percent ended at 17,935. The NASDAQ added 9 points, a 10th percent, 5,064. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 2-tenths percent, closed at 2,100 on the nose. Today's corporate deal involves an experimental drug called ATX-101. Its maker, Kythera Biopharmaceuticals, says it's for, and I'm quoting here, treatment of submental fullness associated with submental fat, which commonly presents as, wait for it here, an undesirable double chin. So, Allergan, the Botox company, is buying Kythera for $2.1 billion to get its mitts on that ATX-101, because who wants double chins? Allergan up 0.25%, Kythera up 22%. Take that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is listener supported. So to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. Did consumers pay more or less for stuff in May than they did in April? The Labor Department issues its Consumer Price Index. A House Foreign Affairs subcommittee discusses the future of property rights in Cuba. And on June 18, 1983, astronaut Sally Ride made history as the first American woman in space aboard the Shuttle Challenger. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Think for a second about the relationships that people have with their doctors. The most personal information is shared. Great confidences are given. And yet there is something that's only rarely talked about: the cost of that care and associated medications. But as Rebecca Plevin explains from KPCC here in Los Angeles, it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
Peter Ubel practiced as an internist for 20 years before he left the exam room to teach at Duke University.
Not that long ago, if a person had insurance, they had really good insurance that covered the vast majority of the expenses. So there really wasn't much to talk about when it came to money.
But these days, there's a lot more to talk about. The Kaiser Family Foundation says last year, 80% of people who got insurance through their job still faced an annual deductible, as much as $3,000 and up. Ubel says that means we all have skin in the game.
When the doctor recommends one medication to us, we might have reason now to ask whether another medicine would be almost as good and a lot cheaper.
There's at least one medical field where these types of conversations are the norm.
Tell me a little about what's going on with Melvin today.
Dr. Diane Tang talks with Morgan Bradley. She's Melvin's mom, and she's concerned about a bump on his face.
Has he been eating well, drinking well?
He's totally fine. That's also why I didn't notice until...
Wait, did you think Melvin was a kid? He's a huge black and white cat. He purrs loudly and doesn't seem to mind as Dr. Tang examines the inside of his mouth. Now, listen to what happens next.
there are a couple of very easy options, one of which we can actually do today for you. And that is something called a fine needle aspirate.
Dr. Tang lays out possible treatments, and then her assistant, Kayla Wilkinson, comes in.
So we have two estimates here. The
first and explains how much each option would cost.
She said that it is most definitely not going to ever get higher than the high point.
Okay.
But just to kind of prepare you, we like to give you a pillow there to for what to expect.
Melvin's owner, Morgan Bradley, says she appreciates getting this information up front.
I mean, it always helps in knowing like what to prepare for and how much money I have to scrounge for.
So can't we do this for humans?
I think it is a model that could work.
With some caveats, says Dr. Reshma Gupta. She's a physician at UCLA who thinks a lot about the costs of care.
I think where it works is that when you're trying to make shared decisions with patients, you come up with all the options that are available for the patient.
But here's the problem. Knowing how much each of those options costs is much more difficult when you're talking humans versus Melvin the cat. A big one is physicians
do not have access to costs of medications or commonly ordered labs or radiology when they're face-to-face with the patient. And so they don't have the ability to actually offer that information to patients.
Ubel, the professor we heard from earlier, says it comes down to one word, insurance.
We all have different insurance plans, and so we all face different costs, and it's almost impossible for a physician to figure out what any given patient has to pay.
So is that going to change? In the long run, Ubel believes improved and innovative technology will make these prices more readily available. But for now, he says, some information is better than none.
We know that the old-fashioned generic antibiotic is going to be cheap, that the brand new high-powered antibiotic is going to be expensive. And how expensive it is might vary from patient to patient. But just knowing the gist of the cost should be enough for doctors and patients to get somewhere in deciding what to do.
But when deciding what to do, Ubel says there's another more nuanced difference between pets and people. We're just not comfortable, he says, talking about the costs of our own care. But Ubel says if we do, we might find that we have more options than we realize. In Los Angeles, I'm Rebecca Plevin for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics. Stephen Dubner is his name. Freakonomics is the podcast that they do, goes along with the books and the blog as well. Dubner, how are you?
Hey, Kai. Everything's good. You know, today I have got for you, Kai Rizdahl,
yes,
a true blue feel-good story where the economist is the hero. How do you like that?
I will believe it when I hear it. How about that?
All right. So Alvin Roth is a professor of economics at Stanford. He won the Nobel a couple years ago, and he likes to solve real-world problems.
Okay.
So he's just published a book called Who Gets What and Why, where he describes the nature of the problems he likes to solve.
Matching markets are markets where money, prices, don't do all the work. And some of the markets I've studied, we don't let prices do any of the work.
All right, matching markets. But I don't understand that, where prices don't do the work. Because that's what markets are, right? Money and prices figure out the whole supply and demand thing.
Usually that is true. But there are some transactions where money isn't allowed to do what it usually does for whatever reason. So think about school admissions, right? College can't just raise its tuition price until the demand meets the supply. You have to find a way to match a candidate with an available slot. And that's what Al Roth means by a matching market. Uh-huh. And here is another case.
You can't buy a kidney. You can't pay for somebody's college education to get a kidney. You can't buy them a car.
That is Ruth Ann Leishman with the United Network for Organ Sharing.
Yeah, so I get it, though. So let me stop you, actually, because you can't compensate people for donating an organ. I totally get that. There is, however, a huge shortfall of organs to be had for donation. So
correct.
What does Professor Roth do about this?
It goes back to the 1970s. A couple scholars had published a paper in a journal of mathematical economics
about how to trade indivisible goods when you couldn't use money.
Okay, so this was just one of those very mathy models that economists like to play around with.
Entirely theoretical. And sort of whimsically, they said, let's call the objects houses. And let's suppose everyone has a house and they can trade houses, but they can't use money. All you can do is barter.
So how can you make a matching market for something that's indivisible and that you can't put a price on? So Roth realized that this model could be adapted to help kidney patients find a potential donor.
But complicating factors, right? You have to be a match. I mean, there's all that biology stuff.
Extremely complicating. Right. And that was really the problem. So let's pretend that you and I, Kai, we both need a kidney transplant.
Okay.
Let's pretend, okay? And that both of us have a relative who's willing to donate one, but that your relative is not a biological match for you and mine isn't for me, which, by the way, is a very common scenario. So wouldn't it be awesome if you could enter all your data and all the donor's data into some algorithm that could magically sort these data from all the transplant centers in the country and match up donors and patients?
I'm just going to guess here that that's the Al Roth connection here. That's what he came up with?
That is the Al Roth algorithm, along with many other people, came up with it. Here again is Ruth Ann Leishman.
It's saving a lot of lives. We have about 600 kidney pair donation transplants a year right now in the United States. In 2000, we had two. We would have stayed doing two or four or six a year without the algorithm.
And Kai, here's a Minnesota man named Ray Book. His wife needed a kidney to survive, but Ray was not a biological match. The algorithm helped out. Ray offered his kidney to anyone who might need it, and his wife got a different donor organ.
It was a very emotional time. I told my kidney, go and do a good job and take care of somebody, and I shed some tears.
So this is economists doing good. Is that what you're telling me, Dubner?
You know, I hate to agree with you on anything, but this is economists doing good. I couldn't have said it better myself, Kai.
Stephen Dubner, half of the Freakonomics team. They've got a podcast as well. Perhaps you've heard it. Dubner, we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out, a reality check of sorts on the breathlessness with which we all, and by we, yes, I mean us too, greet pronouncements from the Federal Reserve. The bond market heard Chair Yellen speak today and could not have cared a fig. The often quoted 10-year Treasury note closed at a yield of 2.3%, right smack where it opened before Chair Yellen said a word. Yeah, that was a big meh you heard from equities today on the Fed. The Dow up 31 points, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ added 9 points, a 10th percent. The S&P 500 up 4 points. That is 0.2%. Robbie Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And oh yeah, this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.